So, good morning. I love the sunlight coming in and lighting all of you up. I got to see the outdoor amphitheater this morning, and I'm sorry it was too damp to be out there. I was looking forward to that new experience of preaching outside, but I'm happy to be indoors with you as well. I wanted to start this morning with a little bit of a reading from email I got. I think on Friday, and the email was from a UU minister in Alabama. When I think of Alabama, I feel afraid. And right now, Alabama just recently passed an anti-immigrant law that's really bad. And so the minister there, Fred Hammond, is someone I've gotten to know over the past few years. And he's served a couple congregations, and now he's working for the district part-time and has been one of the sole voices against the anti-immigrant kind of hate in Alabama. And so this is an email that came out to the Standing on the Side of Love listserv on Friday, and I'm just going to read two paragraphs to kind of start off this morning. So Governor Bentley, who signed this bill into law, announced the law is too complicated to enforce. He stated he is working behind the scenes with law enforcement and businesses to find ways to simplify the enforcement. Right now, law enforcement is not consistent in routine traffic stops. Some police officers are asking only the driver for proof of status, and some are asking every passenger in the vehicle. Businesses are closing because they are unable to renew their license with the state. International corporations are deciding to end negotiations of relocating their firms to the state because of these stringent new laws. Trailer park registrations are expiring, and the owners are unable to renew because they are undocumented. Families are being torn apart. The law is not just complicated, it is devastating to the health of communities on every level. No one here believes that even if this law is replaced, the crisis will be over. The damage of this law and spawning and propagating racism has already been done. Racism has always been present in Alabama. So what this law has also done is jumpstart again the discussion on race and racism in our state. It has galvanized and solidified a movement that might otherwise have continued to languish by bringing together communities, immigrants, and allies, including Unitarian Universalists, to work not only on the repeal of this law, but the core underlying issues of racism and hate. Love indeed is indeed surging through our efforts to heal effectively within this crisis. So that's part of the email from Reverend Hammond, and I was really inspired by what he had to say. I've kept in touch with him over the last couple of years, just making sure that he's doing okay, being in a place like Alabama and trying to spread the Standing on the Side of Love message as well as Unitarian Universalist values and principles. And he always appreciates, I think, the support. And that ties in today to what I really wanted to talk about, which is the growing movement within Unitarian Universalism. I shouldn't say growing, but the continuing movement of social justice. UUs have a long history, we know, of social justice engagement, of doing things for progressive activism in their communities. Early on, Unitarian and Universalist ministers were active in anti-slavery work, abolition work, women's suffrage, civil rights, LGBTQ rights, and marriage equality. And I always joke that Unitarians and Universalists, which were separate religions, came together because they found themselves at the same protests, time after time. Today, when I look at everything going on around the world, it seems like we still have hundreds of these causes to choose from. It is daunting for me, and it's especially how I felt when I finished college. I was already involved in anti-war groups and an anti-racism group, environmental groups, and independent media organizations. But I wanted to get involved in something bigger. I wanted to travel somewhere. I considered the Peace Corps, but ultimately I decided against it. And the summer after I graduated, I heard about this new group that was forming. They were going to open camps out in the middle of the desert along the border between the United States and Mexico to offer humanitarian aid to people who were walking across the border. And a growing number of people were dying in that journey. I slowly got involved. At first, I was turned off because the group was sponsored by a church. At that point in my life, right after college, I was very hostile to organized religion, and I was especially not fond of Christianity. And I thought it was incredibly ironic that a Christian group would be undertaking this humanitarian work, because in my mind, it was Christianity that had caused so many of the problems in Latin America. I had a very simple view of religion and how religion worked, both in Latin America and around the world. This is where, for me, the black and white clarity of everything started to break down. And so today I'm here to talk about the murky waters of social justice, of the things that are ambiguous and vague and nebulous. When we want things to be clear, we want there to be a good and a bad, the good guy and the bad guy, the right and the wrong. And as I've grown up to find, that's almost never the case. I wanted a simple enemy. I wanted the bad guy. And so early on, I figured religion was perfect. It was nothing but, to me, guilt, shame, and violence. Well, I was in for a surprise. As I met more people involved in this humanitarian work along the border, the enemy, which seemed so clear to me, religion, became foggy. I built relationships with ministers and priests who, over time, became my close friends and mentors. And the churches that supported our humanitarian work also supported many other helpful programs in our community. After a couple years, I could easily see both the good and the bad sides to religion. But mostly, I saw everything that was in between. And I learned to be comfortable with that gray area. It wasn't just about the only good, pure stuff and being against the awful, evil, bad stuff. It was all that gray area in between. As I got more involved with the humanitarian work itself, the same thing happened. I felt that everything was clear, that migrants were good, law enforcement was mean, government officials were corrupt, and drug smugglers were just violent killers. Our work in Nogales, Mexico, quickly broke down many of my assumptions. I met people who were deported from the U.S. back to Mexico that were gang members. They volunteered with us, helping to provide food and medical care to other deportees. Some of them, because they needed to start earning money to get by, began to work for the smugglers. I learned that many drug smugglers were themselves struggling to make ends meet. They didn't necessarily want to be involved in the drug trade, but without other options and the promise of good money, I can understand why they chose to do that. We worked with government officials, many who were corrupt, but they also did amazing things for people. And I understood if they didn't do things just right, they could lose their job. Or worse, many of them lived with constant death threats. The pressure was incredible, especially in Mexico. We worked with Mexican consulate officials who would do anything they could to help, and others who only just pretended to care. But they helped us as best they could anyways. And for example, the consulate officials helped negotiate with the Mexican customs so that we could bring in our donations and not have to go through the inspections and pay any duties. I traveled to Washington, D.C. to visit several Congress members and talk about a report that we released. The report was about the treatment of migrants in custody and how many were denied food and medical care. How many were abused, both physically and verbally. Again, some of the representatives in government wanted to help. Others were antagonistic and simply dismissive of our work. But overall, we've been able to make progress in getting better detention standards implemented for Border Patrol and the immigrants that they detain. And of course, we have lots of interactions with Border Patrol. I was a liaison between our group and the Border Patrol leadership in Tucson. I met many agents in the field, some nice and some were not so nice. And talk about murky waters of social justice, our relationship with Border Patrol has always been difficult. But we've had agents come out to our camps in the desert and just bring us donations of extra medical equipment that they had. We've also had others who constantly threaten us with arrest. I've learned as time went by that absolutely nothing was clear. All my interactions with church leaders and government officials, elected representatives, law enforcement, smugglers, and migrants, nothing was clear. And I had to accept that fact, that nothing would ever be clear. Earlier this year, I visited Tucson during my spring break. I stayed in a house that is a faith-based intentional community. It's a house to a lot of clergy and other folks who are all involved in some kind of social justice work. One of the housemates there had just begun looking into a new thing she had heard about. The Greyhound station in Tucson, every single evening, had a van that pulled up and dropped off people who were released from a detention center, kind of in between Tucson and Phoenix. These were immigrants who, for whatever reason, were able to get out of detention and be released. Many of them had court dates that they still had to come back for. Many of them had no idea what they were doing, and a lot of them still had contacts, and they could get the money and get bus tickets and go back to wherever home was. And some still needed a place to stay for a night or two. One of the nights I went, we met a young Chinese girl who had just been released from the detention center. She was probably maybe about 20 years old, and she just looked really afraid. She was asking us over and over to help her out with her bus tickets because she had a ticket from Tucson to New York City. And if you've ever had Greyhound tickets, it's not just one ticket. They kind of fold out. And she had this thing that just folded out of all these tickets and bus transfers. It was a 2.5-day trip with at least 4 or 5 transfers in different cities. And she was really worried. She was really worried she would maybe miss a transfer or somehow get on the wrong bus. We sat with her and went over and over again her ticket and circled the places where she would need to transfer. We wrote down a list. We drew a map and put it on a map. And she was still just so afraid. And we asked her, well, you know, who are you meeting in New York City? And she said she had a brother there. We asked her if she wanted to make a phone call, if she could use one of our telephones. And she said, no, I don't need to make a phone call. She didn't have any money, and she didn't have any food, and she only had a few things with her that she had when they released her from the detention center. We offered her food and she refused it. She had one little thing of crackers and she actually was trying to offer that back to us. Well, I never figured out what was going on. We left that night and I felt deeply unsettled by the whole thing. It wasn't clear to me what was happening. And I found out later this summer when I was back in Tucson visiting the house and they had kept up this Greyhound program. People were going every single night to meet those who were dropped off from the detention center. And there was a pattern. There was a pattern of young Chinese girls dropped off that always had the same story. They had a lawyer, they would pay their bond, and they were all going to New York City. Well, eventually, because we were sort of interacting, someone found out that we were talking to these young girls, and so another Chinese guy showed up at the Greyhound station. As soon as the girls were dropped off from the van, would take them aside so no one could talk to them. And then we heard he was taking them to Los Angeles or something, and then they would fly to New York City. Well, maybe some of you are figuring out what was going on, but it took us until the summer to realize that all these girls were being trafficked. And I had just simply sat there on the bus, or sat there in the bus station next to her and had no idea that this was going on. So when it became clear to me that was happening, I had to admit to myself that here I was, a good-intentioned humanitarian human rights worker, helping a young Chinese girl get trafficked to New York. And this is why social justice work is hard for me. I was really upset about that. And not that I really could have done anything different. But I was so sure of myself, and I was so sure of what I was doing. And yet, and I thought everything was really clear. But it wasn't. So this kind of difficulty in social justice work for me provides the opportunity for faith and my UU principles and values to kind of help out. I've learned over and over again, as much as I try and as much as my graduate school education wants me to believe, that I've learned that I can't rationalize and I can't analyze everything. I've had to learn to forgive myself for my own shortcomings and my own mistakes. And I learn over and over that I don't know everything. I've also learned some important things about social justice work. The most important to me is that it's murky. It's always murky. I mostly understand the big picture and how complex it is, but on a day-to-day level, it's never completely clear. So I've learned to become a better listener. I've learned to slow down. And I've learned to not make assumptions about the people that I encounter or the situations that I'm involved in. I've learned to be more humble and to admit that I don't know everything, even in public. I don't have solutions and answers to everything, and I don't need to. I can simply just be involved, I can be curious, and I can be compassionate. To me, those are the keys of social justice work. These are also the keys to understanding where Unitarian Universalists are moving towards. Next summer will be quite historic for us as a faith and as a denomination. Our annual national gathering has taken it upon itself to change what we call General Assembly, which is usually a business meeting, a time for worship, and a big sort of convention. This General Assembly next year is going to be called a Justice General Assembly. But what does that mean, and what will it accomplish? To me, the General Assembly is still really unclear. A lot of people are definitely working on the details, but I have a sense that it's going to remain pretty foggy right up until the event itself. I say this because things are always changing. In Arizona, when they made the decision to do this new Justice General Assembly, that was 2 years ago. And a lot of things have already changed in Arizona. A lot of the ideas that were proposed are no longer going to work because something has changed. Just in the past 8 weeks with the whole Occupy movement, things are changing. The discourse is changing. The activism is changing. And so in 8 more months, next June, I imagine that things will still be changing. So planning a big event like General Assembly, you can't possibly have all the details worked out ahead of time. So the General Assembly is somewhat unclear. And that might be unsettling to UUs who are wondering if they should go, who are wondering, will it be worth it? Well, this is what I do know. It's an opportunity to live in that ambiguity. It's an opportunity to commit to something that's unclear. Does that sound weird? I don't know exactly what it is, but we're going to go do it. To me, it sounds exciting. All we really have to do is just show up, and we can be involved, we can be curious, and we can bring our compassion. Since the event, Justice GA is going to be focused on immigration, there will be lots of discussion about that topic. If you're wrestling with immigration, GA will be a great place to hear a variety of different viewpoints on the issue. If you're gung-ho and ready to do something, you'll be able to network with others and find projects to plug into, or share the projects that you might already be involved in. There will be events for youth, who all just left. And well, yesterday I met with YRUU leader in Phoenix and started working with her to create events for all the youth that will be coming to GA. They're very excited for the youth component. There will be presentations from non-UU organizations to help us learn about the struggles within immigrant communities. And there will be public witness events. Although the details of all of this stuff is to be determined. I think I want to let you in on a little secret of mine that will hopefully kind of bridge these two issues of social justice organizing and the Phoenix General Assembly. So 2 summers ago, I got this somewhat frantic call from Ken Brown. He's the district executive here in the Pacific Southwest District. They needed someone with some organizing experience to come to Phoenix ASAP and help coordinate a large civil disobedience action and protest against the new anti-immigrant laws in Arizona, SB 1070. Could I come? Well, I quit my summer job the next morning and I drove straight to Phoenix. And I arranged to crash at a friend's house for the 2 weeks that I would be there. I had about 10 days to prepare before over 100 Unitarian Universalists were going to fly, drive, and train into Phoenix to participate in this civil disobedience. We didn't know what the action would be, what the risks were. We didn't know who was going to do it. We didn't know anything. The only thing I knew was that nothing was certain, and I knew that lots of people were showing up. So I did what I figured was the best thing I could do, the 3 things that I listed off earlier. I got involved, I stayed curious, and I had compassion. The rest I figured would magically work itself out. That's where the faith part comes in. Well, the one thing everybody was asking for was a schedule. They wanted to know, what's the schedule of events? We need a schedule. Well, I thought, okay, this is a schedule for civil disobedience. This is sort of like scheduling exactly where a hurricane's going to land a week out. I knew it was a big storm. I knew it would hit land. But outside of that, you can't make a schedule for this kind of thing. So I invented a schedule. I printed it up, and we handed it out, and everybody said, ah, yes, good, we have a schedule. On the morning of the main day of protests, plans were still changing for the civil disobedience, even as we were marching towards downtown after a morning interfaith worship service. So at this point, my schedule became completely irrelevant. The day would unfold on its own. Some 80 people were arrested, including about 2 dozen UUs, ministers, and including Peter Morales, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. That night was spent at a spontaneous vigil at the county jail. The next day, more arrests happened. The next day and night, we were waiting at the jail for people to be released and more vigiling. Spontaneous dance party in the streets, and it rained on us. Everyone handled the impromptu course of events with grace. It was a great demonstration of this kind of social justice and living with ambiguity. What I'm not saying here is that Justice General Assembly next summer will be as unpredictable as civil disobedience was 2 summers ago. I think they're going to have a real schedule of events. But that said, I also think the event will be dynamic. And so I think things will change and morph throughout General Assembly. My hope is that if you all decide to go, and I recommend that you do go, my hope is that you get ready to be involved, to be curious, and to have compassion while you're there. Things won't be clear. We won't be able to fix all the problems of immigration in Arizona, and no one is really expecting us to. We won't be able to analyze everything. We won't be able to have all the answers that we want, but we will be able to be present and have discussions and do some actions and see what unfolds and then talk about it after that and then maybe do something else and then maybe come home. Who knows? But we have to be open to all those possibilities. There's so much to tackle in this world. I get that. I imagine that there are many social justice issues right here within your fellowship. there are issues in your surrounding community. We just had the announcement this morning of a chronic food shortage for those who don't know where their next meals would be coming from right here in San Diego County. Not everyone in the fellowship might be in agreement about which issues are the most important. Even if you decide to tackle certain issues, you may learn that it's more complicated than you thought. At first, what appeared to be clear is actually the murky waters of social justice. So rather than trying to clear everything up and make sense of everything, I think it's important to live in these murky waters, because that's how things usually are. So rather than seeing a task as difficult because it's murky, I've learned to embrace it, to thrive in that gray area, because that's where the bulk of social justice work exists. And as the poet Rumi wrote, out beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I will meet you there. Amen and blessings to all.